Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the Manager of Education and Public Programs at the museum. This episode, I'd like to welcome Associate Professor Anne Elias. And she is Chair of the Department of Art History and a researcher with the Sydney Environment Institute at the university. Today, Anne's chosen a remarkable lantern slide from the Maclay Collection's Historic Photography Collection. So firstly, Anne, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Craig. Thanks for having me.
It's a great, great pleasure to have you on. And actually, you are the first academic staff member to appear on the segment as well. So it's a double pleasure.
Very good.
We're hoping to have many, many more as we go along. But I guess to begin, could you just tell our listeners a bit more about what your role at the university actually entails?
Yeah, thanks, Craig. As you say, I'm associate professor. My role is called Contemporary Global Art, and I'm in the Department of Art History at the university. And as you say, I'm also the chair of department. And what that means is that I oversee the curriculum and research for our department, as well as the day-to-day workings of about 28 people who are across a number of different areas, including film studies, art history, curatorial studies, and museum and heritage studies. So it's quite a busy job. And I work with the, environmental histories, which I see as the study of human interaction with the natural world, especially non-human animals. And through that interest, I'm also a key researcher, as you quite rightly point out, with the Sydney Environment Institute at the university. And listeners may not know, but that body specialises in projects that are about critical environmental concern. They engage with collaborative projects. And I've been involved with a number of those with SEI, as we call it. But my expertise really is in visual culture. And by that I mean art, but not just art, also imagery and popular culture, science imagery, which is why I'm here today, newspaper illustrations and so on. And I look at the intersections of visual culture with natural history, with ocean histories, with war histories and so on. So I've written three books.
I'm very keen to pick you up on that point about the intersection of visual culture, as you describe it, and environmental history and the study of the environment, because I would imagine it's a relatively new phenomenon, this idea of actually thinking of how humans have actually tried to capture that world in an artistic and visual sense. Am I correct, or is there actually a longer tradition of this than most of us would expect?
Well, there's a long tradition of visual arts looking at environments. So you can just think of the history of landscape art, for example. Mm. But there's a very new interest in looking back on the history of art, for example, or the history of visual culture, and seeing it in relation to our contemporary environmental problems, for example, warming oceans, the coral reef bleachings, denuding of the landscape. And what you find in a lot of historical art, for example, is a kind of evidence of the impact that human life has made on the planet and why we're at this very precarious position that we are at today.
Excellent. So it's, again, bringing another perspective to an understanding of issues like climate change, isn't it?
It is, and it's also extending the discipline. The discipline of art history, for example, is really being extended by this revising and relooking at the past and its images through the contemporary. Yep.
That's very, very exciting. You mentioned earlier your books, the most recent one that you published in 2019 called Coral Empire. Could you just give our listeners a sense in terms of the research that you did for that project and, again, how you brought that visual cultural identity into an understanding of coral reefs?
Yeah, a Coral Empire came about because I was actually researching a while before a book on camouflage, and it involved a person I'm going to talk about to you today, a man called William Dakin. And I was thinking about the relationship of coral reefs to the history of aesthetics. And I had noticed how important coral reefs and corals were, for example, to surrealism. And that got me interested in the relationships of visual art, science, and areas of exploration particularly the burgeoning area of underwater photography in the 1920s. And so I pursued a project and a book called Coral Empire on the basis of those intersecting interests.
Fantastic. Well, look, I guess given this podcast is focused on objects, let's now turn our attention to your selection. What item from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection have you chosen today for us to talk about?
I've chosen a particular lantern slide, and it's hard to know what dimensions this lantern slide is, but it's one of my favourite objects in the Maclay collections of the Chow Chak Wing Museum because it's an aquarium photograph.
Yes.
And I've spent a lot of time studying aquarium photographs. Now, it's an aquarium photograph of a scallop and it's labelled Mollusca pectin. I've researched the background of this photograph, who took it, how it ended up in the Chow Chak Wing collection, but I first came across it in the Maclay collections in 2012 when I was researching William Dakin. He was a marine zoologist and he worked at Sydney University as an academic. And I wasn't researching scallops, so the photograph had no immediate use for my research, but something about the image captured my attention and I just felt that one day I would look closely at it. And nearly 10 years later, that's what I've done. It's a lantern slide. It's sometimes referred to as a magic lantern slide.
Oh, that's great.
So made of glass, it's very heavy. I've only seen it as a digitized object, but I've seen many lantern slides, so I can describe them to you. A lantern slide is made of glass. They slotted into a clunky old projector. They've been around since the 19th century. And most importantly, this particular object has a photograph of a scallop in an aquarium copied onto its front so that when light is shone from a projector through the slide, it throws an image on a screen.
It's kind of interesting for our contemporary generation who are so used to digital photography and to, you know, in terms of, you know, a lantern slide being used in a lecture environment or in a teaching environment, of course, with PowerPoint and other digital means of projection today. It's quite astonishing just how much skill went into creating these slides for the purposes of display and teaching.
That's right. And as you say, they were used for lecturing and public lectures, academic lectures, teaching right through the 19th and early 20th century. So they were, as you put it, precursors to data projection. I guess they were part of a collection that would have been housed in a separate room because these objects, they're very heavy, they're very big. Imagine storing glass objects for projectors. You'd need a lot of space, whereas we now just need a desktop and the cloud and we can store as much as we want.
Yeah,
in the old days, which was, you know, the beginning of the 20th century, these were very space-consuming objects.
Yes, definitely. So in terms of the actual image on the lantern slide, could you describe how the mollusk is actually appearing? Our listeners will, of course, be able to see the image if you just follow the links in the introduction to the podcast online. But just in terms of a verbal description, Anne, what do we actually see in the slide?
Well, there's a scallop that takes up pretty much the whole frame of the photograph in a seemingly watery space because you can see the particles in the water. The majority of the image itself is taken up with an eye-to-eye view of a scallop, which is a little bit open. So you can actually see into the gape, as it's called, between the scallop's two valves,
yes,
which is odd. It's a viewpoint that you could only get with the technologies that were being explored at that time. So close-ups, minute detail, the idea of using an aquarium itself was relatively new in the early 20th century. The only way, in fact, that many people could photograph the underwater animals was to put them in an aquarium.
Yes.
This was before Jacques Cousteau and people got under the water,
yes,
as scientists to film animals. So you see this very engaging scallop in a way that you normally never see a scallop that was alive,
yes,
in the process of opening its valves. And on top of its shell, it has a number of marine animals living symbiotically with it. It in itself is a whole environment, and that I find quite intriguing. It's sitting on a rock, and it seems to be grinning at us.
I must say, I found it very otherworldly when I first saw it. It's very evocative, isn't it?
It's evocative, especially someone coming from an art history background and visual culture background. It's very evocative of a particular artist whose name is Odéon Redon, who many listeners will know was a symbolist artist in the 19th century and made many imaginary animals that were half human, half a non-human animal. And to me, when I look at the scallop, I see a hybrid of human and non-human, which others may or may not see.
No, this, it's quite extraordinary. You've already alluded to it a little bit in our discussion, but yeah, as an object that you've been aware of for more than 8 years now, why have you chosen this particular lantern slide to talk about, and how do you see it fitting into the broader pattern of your research over the past decade?
Okay, well, look, I'm really interested in the question of animal eyes, and this came out of Coral Empire because some of the photographers I was looking at, including Frank Hurley, were interested in capturing the eyes of fish. And this intrigued me. I thought, okay, why was this such an interest in the eyes of fish? And I guess it was simply the fact that these are the most remote animals on the planet that you would never normally get to see, let alone see eye to eye.
Yeah.
And there was a real fascination I found with the optics of underwater space and trying to understand the eyes of fish in the early 20th century. People wondering, well, what do fish see when they look at humans? I mean, you can imagine that people who go angling and fishing or swimmers have often thought, well, if the fish sees me, what do they see?
Yes.
And
yes.
I've started tracking that, and that's partly the reason why the scallop eyes attracted me. But then I found out more, and it turns out that scallop eyes are particularly important in the history of science and philosophy in modernity. So that has taken me down a path which makes this particular photograph extremely interesting. And do you want me to tell you what it is?
Yes, please do. I'm very intrigued about this concept. I mean, at what point do scientists actually start thinking about this concept from the perspective of the scallop eye?
I believe it goes back to the 1700s, but I came in on the story, I suppose, with the early 20th century, so the first decade of the early 20th century, when science and philosophy really expanded on the eyes of scallops, because they were remarkable for two reasons. First of all, the number of eyes that scallops have, which can be up to 200 blue eyes around the mantles of its shell. Mm. And then secondly, and I guess this is the most important thing, the perceived similarity of the scallop eyes to human eyes.
Right. Yes.
And it was noted that the retina of the scallop eye is inverted like a human eye. And that idea captured the attention of a philosopher, Henri Bergson, who the listeners will know very well. And he wrote about scallop eyes in his book, Creative Evolution, which he based on science, facts of science. And he asked the question, well, the eyes of pecten present a retina, a cornea, a lens of cellular structure like human eyes. So how can this be? If these two animals, the human animal and the scallop animal, took different evolutionary paths, how can their eyes be so similar? So he proposed a metaphysical rather than a mechanistic explanation for the convergence of what he saw as human eyes and scallop eyes. And he drew on the concept that he's so well known for, which is élan vital, or the impulse to pass life from one generation to another through non-material energy. Okay, so that was one thing. And, you know, I'm not a philosopher, but I really found this fascinating, yes, especially since it involved, eventually, William Dakin, who is this person I have done so much research on, because William Dakin read Bergson's conclusion and he really took issue with it. And what he did, because as a scientist, William Dakin believed in the mechanistic side of evolution.
Right, yes.
So everything came down to physics and chemistry. And he wrote a letter to the editor of Nature Journal, the learned Nature Journal, contesting Bergson's theory. So he took Bergson on, which I find absolutely fascinating. I had no idea that Dakin had this dimension to him, where he was very involved with the cutting edge of modern thinking. So, you know, he was the Challis Professor at Sydney University, and I hope one day someone does a really close study of him. But anyway, he wrote this letter saying how Bergson's theory that human eyes and scallop eyes showed that we had this common elan vital, or common energy in evolution, he called it extremely bad. And he said there was no mysterious agency responsible for the similarity between human eyes and scallop eyes. In fact, he refuted that they were very similar at all. So that's the background story.
That's fascinating. I mean, can you give our listeners a bit more of a context about William John Dakin? When was he actually teaching at the University of Sydney, and what was his scientific background and his training?
Yeah, no, he's fascinating. He began in Liverpool, England, and he trained at various marine stations, including the famous research station at Naples. And he made his earliest mark on academia with research into the evolution of scallop eyes. So he had a vested interest in this. And he published in 1909 a memoir on scallop eyes that was reviewed in the journal Nature, where he wrote his letter to the paper about Bergson. He eventually came to Australia, and he was employed to help the growth of the fishing industry here through his knowledge of marine animals. And then he took up a position at Sydney University. He published a terrific book on the Great Barrier Reef, but one of his best-known books is Australian Seashores. It's dated 1952. It was published posthumously. He died in 1950. And it was really that project carried out in collaboration with Isabel Bennett, the very eminent marine biologist, Isabel Bennett. But my first contact with William Dakin's life was when I researched the history of camouflage, and camouflage as a military art phenomenon and a phenomenon of nature of animals and plants.
Yes.
And that was for a book called Camouflage Australia. And the weird thing is that William Dakin, who had, you know, a finger in lots of civic portfolios, was appointed the technical director for the Australia and Southwest Pacific region to advise in camouflage in the Second World War. So his knowledge of animal camouflage was actually adapted to military camouflage.
But interestingly, that must have brought him into contact with quite a number of visual artists who were actually working with that unit too, weren't they, during the Second World War?
That's exactly right. Yes. And he seconded some of Australia's leading artists like Frank Hinder and Max Dupain. Max Dupain, the photographer, many Dupain photographs in the collection of the Chow Chak Wing Museum, because photography played a big part in camouflage in wartime. And Dakin would send Max Dupain into the sky in Australian Papua New Guinea in reconnaissance planes to take photographs of the ground in order to know what kind of camouflage designs the Allies needed if they were going to conceal their installations and their soldiers.
Fascinating. Yeah. Well, I guess moving back to back to our scallop, the photograph that the lantern slide is from, what date was it actually taken? What date was the photograph captured?
Okay, so the photograph was taken sometime between 1909 and 1911. It wasn't William Dakin who took the photograph, even though William Dakin was a very active photographer, and by necessity, all scientists were photographers. But it was taken by another British marine scientist and photographer, a man called Francis Ward, who some research is now coming to light about. But not a lot is known about Francis Ward yet, but I'm sure more and more will come to light. Francis Ward published a book called The Marvels of Fish Life, as revealed by the camera. And one of the things that he really, really focused on in his work was capturing the eyes of fish. And what had happened is that he actually worked with William Dakin on the Isle of Man at Point Aaron Marine Station, because there Dakin had kept a big aquarium of live scallops for his own research, and Ward had come to work with him, and under William Dakin's direction he took photographs of this particular scallop in the process of turning itself over, its reflex to turn over, and open its valves. So the photograph that you're seeing here of the scallop was taken by Ward at the moment that he wanted to capture the animal opening its valves. That's exactly the moment he wanted to capture.
Incredible. Incredible.
Yeah.
So how did the slide come to be in the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection then? I'm assuming it's via the Department of Zoology, but does it have a long story in terms of its eventual arrival within the museum collection?
One thing, I don't know how it got there. I mean, obviously it got there through William Dakin, and this is the situation that usually happened, because William Dakin had photographs by many other important scientists, British and so on, in his collection, especially his camouflage collection. I'm just trying to think of the scientist Cott. Well, what's his first name? He was a very famous British scientist. And William Dakin had a lot of photographs by Cott in his collection of camouflage photographs. So it was quite normal for people to exchange their photographs with other scientists.
Yes.
And then for those images to turn up in collections all over the world. Talk about the diaspora of science photographs.
Yes.
I think that's what we're looking at here. Yes.
Well, look, I'd like to move on to your personal and emotive connection with the image. I mean, what meaning does the image have to you personally? It's something that you've spent a lot of time looking at very closely while you've been doing this research. How do you find yourself responding to the image each time you see it? Has it changed over the 8 years?
Well, when I first saw that image, as I said earlier, I knew there was something about it that I would end up trying to explore. And what it comes down to, I think, is that I find the image extremely haunting. And that feeling never goes away. It makes me think of all sorts of things. I mentioned the artist Odilon Redon earlier, and as an historian of art and visual culture, I find it really impossible not to see a similarity in the image to the imaginary animals that Redon created. They often grin and stare like the scallop in the photograph.
Yes.
And there's one particular etching of the grinning spider that is very similar in feel, psychological feel, to the scallop photograph. But I find similarities between this photograph and a number of artists. For example, I don't know if you know François Truffaut's 1959 film, The 400 Blows, but at the end of that film, there's a freeze frame where the protagonist Antoine's face is frozen and fills the whole frame as the scallop does.
Yes.
And that scallop has a face to me like Antoine in the end of the film. Projects a gaze that makes you feel like you're really being scrutinized.
That's extraordinary. Now, the question I'm asking everyone who appears on the podcast is this one. In one word, what does this object signify for you?
I would say dream. The word would be dream. So what I mean by that, and it relates to the thinking I do around aquariums, is the effect is to create, I guess, with an aquarium, to create a dream. It's unintentional a lot of the time, but the effect of an aquarium is to create a dream, a kind of ethereal space where animals in particular that would never normally be seen are brought into view by this optical device, which is glass and water combined. Mm. In the same way that dreams might bring into view images that wouldn't normally be seen by the conscious mind. That's the link I make. So dream is the signification for me.
Oh, that's extraordinary. That's really extraordinary, Anne. Thank you. I guess as we start to wrap up, when the museum does open, this particular lantern slide will not be on public display immediately. It may well be in a future exhibition, but of course our listeners can view it on the museum's online collection search right now and just follow the links from the introduction for the podcast. But, you know, is there anything else besides we've already discussed today? Is there anything else you would like our listeners to think about if they actually get a chance to view the image up close?
Well, I think it goes back to the relationship of the scallop to philosophy and science in the early 20th century. And I guess perhaps I'd like people to think about how the seemingly primitive mollusk, this sort of lowly animal that, you know, in the world of classification has always been placed very much below human beings and below land-dwelling and air-breathing vertebrates in the hierarchy of animals. And it usually goes about its life half buried in the sand, never seen. Yet this scallop managed to provoke one of the early 20th century's perhaps most controversial theories about evolution, which was based on the idea of the convergence, possible convergence of human and animal vision. I think that's what I'd like people to think about.
That's extraordinary. Thank you, Anne. Of course, all the research you've done on this slide and other images, are you intending to publish?
I've got an article that is written around this image of the scallop and the background to the photography of it. It's now under review with the journal, and I guess I'm going to have to wait 5 to 6 months to see what the reviews say of the article and if it will be published, but fingers crossed.
Well, look, we look forward to reading it when it is out. We've been joined on Object Matters today by Associate Professor Anne Elias. Thank you so much for joining us today, Anne, and for sharing your knowledge and your research into this remarkable image, which has certainly given me personally a whole new perspective on the photograph, but hopefully our listeners as well too. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, Craig.
The Object Matters podcast is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chow Chak Wing Museum pay our respect to those who cared for and continue to care for country. Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.